I've wondered whenever I've like listened and realized that the story that I lived was the story I had to tell. I couldn't just jump straight into a teaching memoir and like 8 easy steps on how to love yourself. And I thought, you know what? Anyone raised with, and I think I say that something along those lines in the prologue, like anyone who's felt like they couldn't live up to some standard that was given to them can relate to this.
That's Canadian author Jessica Evans on her debut memoir, Fade to Light, How I Learned to Dissolve Darkness. Do you ever feel like a hamster on the treadmill of life? Welcome to She Walks the Walk, a movement I started to help women lead more inspired, more authentic lives. Thanks for joining us. Hey everyone, welcome back to episode 2 of this season's podcasts. Jessica Evans, Lordy. We had a virtual sit down just a few months prior to the release of her debut memoir, and I was drawn to her story because, as you know, She Walks the Walk is all about living our truths. I found it fascinating that she grew up in a closed religious society, literally known as the truth. But she decided to leave it and her family all behind. And then she was faced with a brave new path to walk. Without any rules to follow, who would she be? Her story, in fact, her opening line, had me hooked. Quote, "I discarded my virginity all over the backseat of a Chevy Astro van when I was 20. End of quote. As an aspiring writer myself, I was impressed that Jessica took the time to share the evolution of her journey. And I'm telling you, if you are anyone who has grown up living under a veil of expectations, living with the feeling that your love is attached to very specific outcomes only, this is a conversation for you, and this is a book you will want to read. Let's listen in as Jessica and I chat about all the things.
I met you through the wonders of social media and Instagram and through a mutual friend. And I became very interested in your writing journey, specifically because I'm also interested in writing. And I thought, wow, this is a person that's decided she wants to do something, is following through with it, and has done it. So we're here today to talk about your new book.
Thank you.
Fade to Light.
Got mine here too.
Yay. Could you start by telling us, first of all, where you are, something good about your day, and what you're most excited about?
Well, where I am is I'm in my living room in Courtenay, British Columbia. So on Vancouver Island, the way west coast of Canada, which is sort of funny because I grew up on the way east coast of Canada. So from one ocean to the other, and I love it here. My day, I'm pregnant. I'm 31 weeks pregnant. And for a while there, I was relying a lot on my partner to help me with meals and food and things like that because of fatigue. And today I made my own lunch.
Woo!
I'm still good to ask him for support and he's still happy to show up, but it just kind of makes me feel like a little bit more of an adult whenever I can take care of myself too. And then what was your other question about what is good?
The other question is, what are you excited about? And obviously, a couple of obvious ones.
I've been excited to connect with you today. Just seeing it coming up in my calendar and being like, ooh, and yeah, just like I said, I wash my hair for this.
Okay, and I did too. I have curl envy though, as we've already discussed. We are, specifically me, I'm very interested in telling the stories of transformation in other women. And you have a big story of transformation. So can you give a synopsis in a couple of minutes of what your story is about and why you felt compelled to share it?
Yeah. So the story, as it goes, I grew up in a closed society in Nova Scotia, something that some people do refer to as a cult, but I don't need to be attached to that symbol, that name, because it seems that people get into like David Koresh in Waco, Texas. Now that's a cult. And it's like, I'm not here to call it anything. I'm here to say that it was work to break free of that conditioning and that conditional love. So I threw myself into rock climbing, which was amazing. I haven't climbed for a while, but I still have that level of fitness in my body, like somewhere. It was just an amazing experience to climb all over North America and other places. I've climbed in Africa and Mexico, and yeah, it was an amazing journey to go on. But then I started to become disillusioned with climbing because I realized that if I didn't climb regularly and stay at a certain level of interest with the sport, that too was a little bit of a closed society. So I had traded one for the other. And I did one of those accidental fresh starts, end of a relationship, new job, new city, like all the things, which I don't know if I'd recommend that to anyone to do on purpose, but it's one of those things that even if you had sat me down and said, this is how hard this is going to be, I would have done it all anyway. And so just no regrets there. And in a moment of specifically a very low moment, I came up with what I refer to as my love project, based on a quote from a book of what would it feel like, something along the lines of what would it feel like to fall in love with myself. And I went, I can do that. I think that's what I need to do. And this was early 2013, so a little bit before lots of hashtag self-love and, you know, candles in the bubble bath, the stuff on social media and things, which I definitely don't discount. I love seeing how much self-love there is, even just that content, the attitude, the term that's out there right now. But back then it was to be able to keep living. I didn't realize how much I try not to say my conditioning because that's still owning it. I didn't realize how much of the conditioning from my upbringing that I was still under. Deep shame and guilt and lack of acceptance of my own story. And the love project took me through acceptance. Yeah. And dealing with the deep grief that I was still holding of the grief and shame of having that upbringing.
So, and specifically your upbringing, it was tied to a lot of conditions. There was some very specific ideology around what you can and cannot do, what's right and what's wrong. Talk to us a little bit specifically about the sex piece and the marriage piece.
Yes. No premarital sex. It was only for marriage. So even if there was a chance that someone was showing an interest in me, which they often didn't, the religion is, they refer to themselves as the truth. That's how I grew up with being with the phraseology of I'm in the truth. You're not in the truth. They were in the truth. That person was in the truth and they've left. So that's the way I refer to it in the book. And that's a heavy term, right? Of the concept of owning your truth or learning your truth. Well, I grew up with something way bigger than that. So even if, you know, a boy in the truth liked me, which rarely happened, you could only really pursue anything if there was a readiness for marriage. And, you know,
yeah,
masturbation's wrong, premarital sex is wrong, all of it's wrong and bad and just guilt and shame.
And the shame.
So much shame, yeah.
So, and it struck me that this is, you know, an extreme fundamental type of religious thinking. And I grew up, going to church and having to believe in God and going to Sunday school, similar kind of doctrine that, you know, sex was something you waited for until you were married and that you didn't, God forbid, you ever shacked up or lived in sin with anyone. Those concepts were things that I carried with me. And as I started to like break them, or not fulfill them.
Yeah.
I would do things like avoid seeing my grandmother because I knew that she knew. How can she not know I'm living with this person? And I do love him, but I'm not married to him. But what you went through was on a much deeper level. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was able to kind of stand up to my parents and just say to them, look, you know, I'm not you. I love God, but this is what's working for me. And by the way, I'm already on the pill and that ship has sailed. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So how did you find the courage to actually start taking those steps to reinvent yourself and actually start to break free?
Yeah. And first of all, I just want to say, I'm so glad that your parents were accepting that you were able to take a stand. And I love hearing those stories from people. I don't want everyone to have my story and my estrangement from my birth parents, from my origin family. You know, I was told a story. So you've probably heard about my Aunt Ruth, who is mentioned off and on throughout the book. She comes up quite a bit. My dear Aunt Ruth is my grandmother's sister. And I visited with her whenever she was 91. And Uncle Bill, her husband of, I don't even know, like 60 something years, he had just passed away a few months before. So I jetted to Nova Scotia to see her because I knew if one of them went, the other one was going. And so I just sat with her of just like, I am a sponge. tell me everything. Tell me all the stories. I'm very sentimental. I love knowing about family history and things like that. And she told me a story I'd never heard before whenever I was apparently very little. Like, I mean, like crawling around on the ground or like toddler little, that my grandmother looked at me and said to my Aunt Ruth, she said, no one's going to tell that little girl what to do.
Wow.
So I feel like I was born this way. I was meant to have this journey, to be honest. And I don't think that's a coping mechanism of, you know, needing to go deeper into therapy or something. I really, in my heart and soul, I feel like this is the way it was going to go for me.
Yeah. And you know what? I can relate on like a much different level from my own background of having been controlled with so much regulation in the industry that I worked in. And I do want to talk to you about the career that you left. Yeah. You know, when you have your own ideas and you have a desire to self-express and to share and to discover things on your own, and you're just sort of like kept in this box, it's like the death of your soul.
Yep.
And in the book, I didn't actually get to this chapter, but I know that you had an experience, and if you're comfortable and you want to talk about it, where you just felt like you couldn't go on anymore. How did you deal with writing about that?
So that's the chapter called Cumberland Down. And that's after I've left a relationship that wasn't healthy, wasn't right for me. I committed so quickly to someone based on ideology and wanting to be loved. He said, I love you. I moved in. Like, that's basically what happened. Writing about it was cathartic. And it's something that I have been alluding to. So I wrote about the Love Project in a Medium article in January 2020. And I mentioned something about how I wasn't doing well. Like, I had gotten out of a relationship and I wasn't doing well. And that was my first step towards speaking of self-harm and suicide. And then I did a collaborative video and I asked people to say I love you to themselves and send
I love that.
Say I love you to yourself, see how it feels, maybe video it, maybe tell me about it, maybe. And in whenever I got all of the videos in from people, which there was, I think, 43 or so videos came in, which I went, oh my God, there's a story to tell here, because I could see for so many people how difficult it was to say I love you. Mm-hmm. Some people say I love you to the camera and it's cute, but a lot of people went into the depth of what that actually means. And I felt compelled to tell my story. So whenever I put together all of those videos and worked with an editor and said, okay, well, how do I want to string these together? And I talked about it for the first time. And I think how I put it was, so it's a very strong illusion. I think I called it, I wasn't sure I wanted to go on, or I wasn't.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't a fan of continuing that life thing. Like, it was pretty lightweight, but it was my
subtle, first but heavy. Yeah. It was subtle, but heavy. And do you now that you've, you know, written these things down, is it your hope that you're shining a light on, you know, the possibility for moving forward amidst like deep shame and feeling like there's no way to reinvent yourself and just the impossibilities of like grief and loss? Yeah. Is that a hope of yours that you'll help other people through that period?
It is. I started writing the book for that, I want to give other people hope. I want to share. I want to inspire. And then it shifted into actually, I need to write this book for myself. I need to write these stories. I have a very small, like mom and pop publishing company that have been helping me on the path to publish. And I wonder if maybe if I had, you know, tried to land a really big book deal, if maybe they would have said, whoa, tone that down. Maybe don't talk so much about, you know, maybe it would have been a little bit more encapsulated, but I wrote the book that I had to write. And I do feel strongly though about, it's okay to wonder if you want to live. It's okay to choose to live because that's passion, right? To want to live and to want to feel it, to continue to feel.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
There's no shame in deciding to live. There's just seems to be this societal shame of, again, from our Judeo-Christian background and structure of suicide is the ultimate sin sort of thing. And yeah, so to write about it, to read it in the audiobook as well was actually, it was one of the, it wasn't an easy chapter to read. It wasn't like I was on the road trip talking about meditating in the sun, climbing. But it felt very empowering to read it, to be honest. I think you'll be able to hear that in my voice in the audiobook for sure.
I'm really excited to have access to the audiobook. And I have a lot of people in my She Walks the Walk community that actually they're the ones that got me onto audiobooks because I listen to them when I walk and it's a lot, it enables me to do something that I need to do for my own self-love, which is move my body and walk, but also take in something that's nourishing for like my spirit and my brain and to learn. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah. And you did mention earlier, just to come back to that, you said something along the lines of, why was I compelled to tell the story? I tried to tell Sam not to tell this story. I tried so hard to not have to tell my personal story. I wanted to talk about the Love Project. I wanted to be inspirational. I wanted to talk self-partnership, self-love, blah, blah, blah. And then once I got into it, I thought you're missing a layer. I'm just one more, because I'm a pretty upbeat person, pretty funny. I've got ringlets. Like you're gonna see this person that's just like self-love. Oh my God, you need to do it. And I can imagine someone could be like, oh, you don't have any problems. You're fine. Like it's easy for you. So to be able to go into the depths, and some of those chapters in there, especially at the beginning of the book, I saved those until the end of the audio sessions to record them. They're still really. Not heavy, not, I don't know how to describe it, but it takes something from me to read them. There's still just like, whoo, that happened. So I tried not to tell it. And then I got to the point where I can't honestly talk about why self-partnership and self-love has been so important unless I talk about being raised in a way where I shouldn't even deserve life right now based on the amount of sins that I accumulated sort of thing.
Yeah. And the context that you give makes it even that much more powerful. So let's talk about self-partnership. Because you talk in the book about, you know, being single and the shame about being single. And, you know, there's like this constant pressure. Do you have someone? Are you married yet? Et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering if self-partnership is like a buzzword or a concept that you think Like, do you think others are aware of it? Because I'd never actually heard of it.
Really?
Really, okay, and truly.
I didn't make it up. My structural editor had the same thing and said, oh my God, the self-partnership thing. And has a friend who's going through a divorce or something and was like, I told them about it and it makes sense. I forget who it was. There was some celebrity that came out and saying, I'm self-partnered. And then there was like a little buzz in the tabloids of like, who says that sort of thing. And maybe it is, but words are powerful, right? And
I was single, just going to say, words are powerful. Lack.
Single yeah. kept meaning lack for me. I couldn't mm-hmm. own it. I had a friend that dared me to be single for a month. And I got through that month. And then I felt lack. Like the Thomas who I talk about in the book, who I you know, we barely dated for 3 months and I moved in. He felt like it was time for me to have a boyfriend again. So it was just sort of like, who's available? Like I shouldn't just be out here on my own. So whenever I really dove into self-partnership, it changed everything. And there's like probably a year or two that's kind of compressed into that chapter. Cause I don't have these big stories of what it means to have the power of deleting dating apps, about not mm-hmm. swiping, not having the up and down of, did they swipe back? Are we going to meet? Is there chemistry mm-hmm. in person? It was just, it was like there was this like a leak in me. If I was a bucket of energy, there was just this leak that was constantly running towards who's looking at me, going to a party and okay, who's that? Oh, he's cute. Does he have a wedding ring on? Okay, never mind. Like, just who even am I? Where's the energy? It's just a waste. It was a waste for me.
It's exhausting. And I mean, there were so many things that I can relate to, like on a much different scale, but I think there's so much in here that's relatable to the everyday woman, mm-hmm. as particularly women in our generation. And I'm pretty sure, like, I don't know how old you are, but I'm in my 40s and maybe you're only in your 30s.
Yeah.
Okay. But the single piece really hit a nerve with me, because my whole life it was one of, do you have a crush on anybody? Oh, who's your boyfriend? Like my mother in particular, and I love her to death, but it was almost like she was like desperate for me to be with someone and then she could relax. And when I did end up in a relationship with a guy I met in grade 11, and we were together for 7 years, we were engaged, and guess what? He was also going to be a dentist. She just felt like Samantha is going to be taken care of. Yeah. And I went from one thing to another until I met him. And then as it turns out, he dumped me before the wedding. And then I immediately got into a relationship with the rebound guy, who I then married. Exactly. Now we are still together. And I do believe that, you know, it's all meant to be, but the feeling of fear of what if I'm alone mm-hmm. was always like an undercurrent for me. I couldn't imagine being alone. And it's only now that I'm happy and I'm settled that I can honestly say I'd be fine with myself, knowing who I am on my own. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I really do.
It's just like, and it makes me very careful with my own two daughters about asking, you know, I'm interested in their lives and I want them to come to me because I'm interested and share things with me, but I don't want the pressure or the assumption that they're going to be a mother, that they are going to end up with anybody, because I felt that my whole life.
Yeah. 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 That's I just relate so deeply. I was never able to be like fully good in the truth because of my family's rank and my brothers who went before me and my dad's role in the church, et cetera, et cetera. there was like a little bit of a glass ceiling to just how good, capital G, I could get. And mm-hmm. so I wasn't desired by the truth guys. And also, you know, I use pronouns she, they, I mix and match. And I didn't have that chance as in my upbringing and as a child and as an adolescent to explore that about mm-hmm. maybe I would be more androgynous. I'm not sure. I just kept being told, like, you are a girl, you are a female, this is what you do, and you serve men and you need a man, and your crowning accomplishment is a wedding, blah, 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 blah. And it never felt right to me. And I was what they called back then a tomboy. And mm-hmm. I remember when cute boys from the class came and called on me to go catch spiders together, because I loved spiders. And people say, when I tell that story, oh, they were actually, like, they were hitting on you, they were interested. I said, no, I was one of the guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't able to excel. And I saw the girls in church that were, they were so pretty, and they wore their makeup just right. And they had, like we were talking about before, like, they had their straight 90s compatible hair. And I wasn't afraid of getting dirty, and just never really felt like I fit in. And from the very beginning, it was that sort of black sheep feeling of being in that religion. I just tried so hard to fit in for so long, and then finally just was like, this is BS.
So talk to me a little bit about, you know, you talk about you would walk to work and literally be muttering under your breath about your salary. And I mean, this I relate to a lot, because I left a yellow brick road that was laden with security and money. And, but it was crushing who I really was inside. But society taught me that, you know, you need these things. And they're important. And because you are a woman who can have everything, you know, how dare I be ungrateful or walk away from that? You also had the courage to say, no, yeah, not going to do it anymore. And you were incredibly successful.
Yeah, I am. And that was born of, how would I even accurately describe that? A little bit born of desperation, like a little tiny smidgen. I did bring myself to broke getting out of the relationship with Thomas. I got into, I did my yoga teacher training. So I was teaching yoga, and I moved back to Squamish, which had been home many times over. I moved back to Squamish and I was teaching yoga, and most of the teachers, maybe all the teachers I met, you know, there wasn't a lot of money in teaching yoga, unless you're one of like the big people at the, you know, the top of the bill in Wanderlust, if you remember the big yoga festival that happened for mm-hmm. a while. And I was just someone who really wanted to have a personal connection with people and to teach people. And I brought my love project into that and would teach my students. And it was a big theme in my class of like telling yourself, I love you. That was woven through all of my classes. But there wasn't money in it. And the other teachers I found had husbands. They had partners. They were from a dual income family. They could have had a wife, whatever. They were from a dual income family. And I was just there making maybe $50 a class or something.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine that I talk about in the book, Naomi, encouraged me. She said, like, you've got skills, go back to the business world. You've got a, like, you're just broken about money, just go back. I'm like, okay. So I went back and I got carried away. I just got really carried away because of the story that I could be, you know, I could, mm-hmm. I could be this certain level in a company. And I was, you know, it's a smaller company, but I was like, worked for the VP and the president. Like I was a boss. I had a team. I was overseeing every project, every client, like I was ultimately responsible for so much, and it was really cool. And then I just got carried away with what does it all mean, and was making more and more money, and got to the point of saying, like, okay, I'm making all this money, like, should I buy a Tesla? or an Audi. Like I was looking at Audis. Like I think they're beautiful cars. I knew I didn't need that car, but I just thought, what's the good of making this money if people can't tell? And I knew.
That's so honest.
I knew that it wasn't right for me. I knew. And I just wanted someone to dare me to leave. I fell into that. I'm going to mumble about my job because I don't feel appreciated, blah, blah, blah. And I think what I said whenever I handed in my resignation letter, I said, I'm in a nest that's too comfortable and I have to make sure I can still fly.
Oh my God.
It's too comfy.
Yeah.
Every 2 weeks I got this fat paycheck. I owned a 3-bedroom, 3-bathroom, double garage house on my own. Like I could take these big trips, blah, blah, blah. And I just kept on telling myself, like, get to work. You're making good money. Shut up. But I knew,
yeah.
I knew it wasn't right for me. And honestly, I don't think I'm suited to be an employee.
Well, I love when you talk about, I think there's one line in your book. This is towards the end when you talk about, you know, there's no more like team chat.
Yeah.
Just like just the constant like bloop 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 bloop, which I can relate to. And although I'm incredibly busy now in reinventing myself under my own circumstances with what actually interests me, it's different because I have boundaries. I know what matters. I don't have to listen to like whining of anybody else, not saying you were surrounded by people who whined, but it is different when you build something for yourself. And so tell us a little bit about that. How was that process for you?
Going freelance.
Yes.
Well, I had a company on the back burner. So I had the company on the back burner. I put it, I think the term is that I just set it to dormant. It's a corporation. So I had been doing that whenever I moved in with Thomas, because Thomas was, he was freelancing in a completely different field, but he just said, freelancing's amazing. You should do it. And I was like, I'll do whatever you just keep saying you love me and I just want your approval. And so, yeah, I quit my job. I moved in with him and I started this company and just started looking for clients, which there weren't a lot back then. So whenever I was teaching yoga, I also ran that through the same business entity, if you will. And then whenever I went back to project management contracting, I woke the business. I woke the business back up. And that's like whenever Naomi told me to just get back out there. You've got all these skills. Just use them. And I meant to keep teaching yoga and have clients. And I did. I got into this really comfortable spot. And then I got that opportunity to work at the agency and have that highfalutin boss position. And I felt like I was just proving this big point of the church that said that I couldn't and the parents said that you can't and being prevented from going to university and shame about not having a university degree because I was really young in my career. I was 21 working with, you know, 30 and 40 year olds and up and hiding how old I was because technically I should have still been in school and graduating at 22. So I was lying
right.
about my age. I just said I was 26.
Yeah.
And so,
wow.
I basically lied about my age until I turned 40 and I just called it Freedom 40 of, yeah, okay, yeah, that's, I'm my age now. I finally caught up with the age that I'd been lying about saying I was older to cover this shame about not having a university degree.
And it's so interesting because nobody would have really questioned it. Because you talk about this in your gratitude section that you're actually grateful for, you know, the requirement, like you were picking out spelling words from a dictionary because you were already so far advanced due to the reading, et cetera, when you were, you know, 5 and 6 and you were skilled at talking to groups of people. Like these are all things that, you know, you can't necessarily. I mean, you can go to university and I guess learn how to be persuasive and whatnot, but you gained these skills because of what you went through.
Yeah. I have no fear of public speaking. You could give me a TED talk tomorrow and I just ad lib it and have fun. I just, like, I would love that.
That's amazing.
It's That's unique, amazing. Isn't it? Yeah, it's really unique. And I'm grateful for that.
It is. And there's a big part of me that, because the storyline that I was fed growing up was, oh, well, you need to go to university. So it was like the opposite, you know, storyline from your being raised in the truth. And it was the same for my brother and my sister. And you know, I happily went off to university and I got a degree in music, which was great. It didn't end up connecting with what I really wanted to do with my life, but it was something that I enjoyed. And I remember when my brother, who's 7 years younger, went off to school, and he felt like he was forced into getting some lousy BA to please our parents. And what he really wanted to do was just go and be a carpenter. But there was all this shame and stigma around, well, you can't go and get a trade. And I just, the whole thing makes me absolutely crazy that we have these formulas for how to be in the world.
Yeah.
And the fact that you didn't end up going to university for your own situation, it just means that for me, like, it makes me realize, like, there's always this other path. We don't have to go pursue higher education. So many people don't, and they come out just fine.
You don't.
It's life that becomes their teacher.
Yeah. And isn't it all just the same, it's kind of like same of, like, anything that says, well, you have to do this in life. I don't know. I think, like, we like, for me, I don't want to have any have to's, right? Yeah. Other than, you know, breathing some good old oxygen and drinking enough water and, like, things that are reflexes that my biological body's going to take care of anyway. But the conditioning exists, especially for our generation and the ones older than us as well. You have to this, you have to that. Do you have to have a drink when you turn 19? Do you have to go to clubs because you can? Do you have to date just because other people exist? Do you have to, like, do you have to go to this type of school or that type of trade? I feel that we know deep down, and I talk in the book about my practice of the deep listen, which is a big part of my my love project, of being able to hear, going completely silent in meditation and just listening. And in there is whenever I could hear whatever it was, my soul, my higher self, I don't know, my inner best friend, of saying, this job is killing you. This job is killing you. This is not your purpose. And one of the reasons why I quit was because I knew I needed to write. And I knew I needed to write a book. It's not just something that was like a bucket list. I want to be an author, blah, blah, blah. That's still pretty trippy about becoming a published author. Like, having actually, like, pulled it off is still kind of like, get back to me in 2024. Maybe I'll be, I'll have adjusted to that. But I knew I had to write a book. And so I quit my job. I ended up moving. Like, I did, I sold that big 3-bedroom, double garage, blah, blah, blah house. And I traded it in for a small 1-bedroom rancher with a bigger yard, and had all sorts of just, like, really beautiful serendipitous moments once I started to listen. Like, before I was listening and saying, shut up, it's whenever I started listening and said, okay, guide me.
Grief is a really compelling theme in your book, the grief and loss. And as someone who is going through a period of grieving right now, I can attest to the weirdness that is out there in terms of how society in our westernized world deals with grief, and how people don't know what to say, and how there's this sort of pressure to just kind of get over things. What have you learned about grief? If someone hasn't read your book, what would you say to them and they were grieving?
Grief is a constant. There's always some type of grief, whether it's a what I refer to as nano grief, which is going to the grocery store and they're all out of the one thing that you went there for. There's going to be a response of letdown, a plan being changed, even if it's someone canceling something that you were looking forward to, or concert being postponed, or whatever. There's going to be a grief response. Grief is so normal, and it's just a part of day-to-day life. And I feel like we only really, grief has to be capital G grief on, losing a loved one, car accidents, divorce, like big, big changes. And if we only let grief exist there, then we've cheated ourselves out of all the warm-ups of, I'm feeling inclined to be a jerk at the grocery store because someone took the last cart. Actually, what's happening is I'm feeling the pain of the grief of something not flowing as smoothly as I thought it would be. And I can name it. And then I can calm down and I can say, oh, that's you, grief. Okay. Hi. Shopping cart's not a big deal. Then being out of olive oil is not a big cool, but you're having a grief response. So what do you want? That's part of self-partnership, is having this kind dialogue with myself, with Jessica, which took a little bit to be okay with. But yeah, just what do you need? Okay. This is grief. It comes up so often, and it doesn't need to shut me down anymore. And if I can
be I appreciate through all of the little delays that we've had, but most recently, the compassion that you have, that it comes from a place of authenticity and just the feeling of being seen. It makes me want to be kinder to myself. And the whole idea of self-partnership, I know that I have a long way to go because I'm basically an asshole to myself. So I appreciate that concept. And like I said, I'd never heard the idea, just being okay with loving myself as I am. I don't need someone to fill me up. I'm good. I'm whole. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to unpack, and I'm super thankful that you were gracious with me as I bailed over and over from our calls.
The timing, I don't think the timing was right for any of us, for anyone, anywhere, for the weeks that we kept in touch. And it's for self-partnership and self-friendship too, right? Just of why is it okay to say I'm an asshole to myself, but we wouldn't say I'm an asshole to my friends, or like that friend of mine is an asshole. We just wouldn't keep those people around.
No.
And again, it's something to do with upbringing and conditioning and society and all these really big things that seem to wire us in. And I mean, friends that I have of many different generations and all sorts of different genders, of just like, there's this honor in being hard on ourselves. And I'm not saying that I'm not hard on myself. Like, I still have certain expectations, but I've moved through the really try hard and the perfectionism and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I still have to work on those things.
We're all working on things.
Yeah. So you are going to be a mom soon.
Yeah.
You are having, you are in your third trimester.
Yeah,
and oh my goodness.
I've been getting baby kicks this whole time.
I miss that so much. So tell me where your head is with that. Like, what do you feel about the kind of mom you want to be and what lies ahead?
It is a trippy second chapter because the book ends with me saying self-partnership, self-love, the journey is long, et cetera, et cetera. And now I'm married and pregnant. So the exact life that had been set out for me that I was supposed to get to when I was between 18 and 22 of being married and cranking out babies. I'm still a pretty decent cook and I can sew though. So that was nice to have those skills. It's trippy. It's just really, really surreal. And I know that I can show up for this little one as a much better parent than if I had done this with any of my previous partners, and at any point earlier in life, because I am so much more easygoing. I feel like I would have had so much of my own thrashing that I still would have been doing that I would have brought them through. And it's not to say that I'm like, there is no perfect parent. It doesn't exist. And, we've been joined by the kitty cat. I really hope that I'm able to continue self-partnership with myself, because I've heard it's incredibly challenging, because I also just only want to take care of this little one. Like, I am fiercely protective of them already.
Yeah.
Like, there is just this instinct and drive and how I want to birth them and how I hope to be able to nurture them. I'm probably not going to go back to the consulting business anytime soon. Like, not if I can help it. If I can, this book has been so important to me for the last 2 years. And if I could share these messages and just keep, and my partner's in for it as well. Just like, what can we do so that I can keep living that purpose? Because honestly, the consulting business has gotten a little busy again, and it's very running around humans panicking about things, and it's taking time away from my messaging and my ability to share this. So I'm excited. I'm excited to go deep into it. I'm still kind of shocked because I had closed the door on becoming a mom so many times in my life. So many times. And then here I am. So we've got, I think it's like 6 weeks-ish, 6 to 8 weeks in and around there, based on whenever they are planning on being born, which I wish they would tell me. And we'll see how it goes. There is a second book in me I want to write about. There are other things that I want to share, but there's no pressure to do that anytime soon, because I have a lot of friends that have made the transition to motherhood, and I know it becomes a very big priority, and as it should. I'm not going to put this little person aside because I've got some big list of things to do. I've traveled the world. I have climbed hard grades. I have climbed mountains. I've done so much. I've run, I have gone on distance runs. I have done all sorts of crazy things with this body. And so now I'm going to do the craziest, most natural thing. And I'm growing a human. I'm hosting the body for a little human right now.
It's so trippy, isn't it?
Can't wait to meet them. Yeah.
When you become a mom and you're already filled with all that love for this unborn child, but when you actually hold this person in your arms and feel that bond, that's going to be the most important thing. Everything else will fall off. Mm-hmm. It's just as you say, you know, whether or not you go back to consulting, or that if you and your husband can find a way so that you can just sort of focus on this new path and getting your message out and maybe doing another book, but mostly being there for your child. Like, how incredible will that be?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And it was the conversation that, because my mom and I had been keeping in touch and we had been keeping it light and just not talking about the religion for years. And then whenever she, when they shunned my brother and his children, I was like, I can't even, because I think I was like 29 or 30. And I was just starting to feel that what if parental maternal instinct. And I called my mom and just said, I feel strongly about my children that don't even exist, that may never exist. How can you be like this with us? We're here. And she couldn't hear it. It was devil messaging. It was Satan's world. It was demons speaking through me. And that's real for her. That is very real. So it's been years that I've had a hunch that I would really feel strongly about being a mom. So off I go.
Off you go. Well, on that note, tell us where we can find you and what you know about when your book is coming out, where it will be available, where people will be able to find the audiobook.
It's going to be up on Amazon, so it's an on-demand publishing, and then that also means you can order it through any bookstore that you can look up a book. It has an ISBN. It's registered with the Canadian Archives, like things like that. Like it's a book.
It's got it's a book
code and stuff.
By the way, the cover is beautiful.
Thank you.
I love the cover.
Yeah, the cover really, whenever I did that that image, I was like, oh, that's the book cover. That's easy. The book is out there. And then the audiobook will be up on Audible.
On Audible. Yay! Yeah. That's so great. That's so great. Well, I'm a fan. I'm a fan who's been living vicariously through you in your writing journey. Thank you. I'm a fan of all your transformation. And thank you for staying with me for so long. I know we're past our time. So that is a wrap on our conversation. I just want to wish you the absolute best of luck. Most significantly in your journey as a mom, because that's been the most fulfilling thing for me and my life. And I just can't wait for you to feel all those things.
Yeah, it's already been an unreal amount of love for someone who learned love, who learned unconditional love, who learned how to love themselves. Learn, and now this is feeling like just so natural and so amazing with this little one, and also with my husband too, to have such a deep partnership with another person and to be able to allow that. It's a true blessing. I'm very grateful.
That was Jessica Evans discussing her new memoir, Fade to Light, How I Learned to Dissolve Darkness. I just love Jess's frank, candid writing style. And I'm grateful she found the courage to share her story, not just about her love project, but about what it means to truly break free from her culty upbringing and from societal conditioning. Jessica's book is available in paperback and also for Kindle on Amazon. You'll find her on Instagram at Jessica Evans Writes. And if you'd like to connect with me, I'm at She Walks the Walk on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode, drop us a comment or a like. And remember, you don't need to let anyone or anything dictate your path. You can walk your own road.